This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's cold. The cold snap leads to power outages, suffering for the city's homeless, and now snow in some unusual places. With homeless shelters at capacity, Mecklenburg County refuses to open warming centers and draws heat for that decision. Meanwhile, county commissioners approve a land swap allowing the expansion of Pearl Street Park. The Panthers are in the playoffs. A team has been assembled to sell the team, and that sale raises questions among PSL owners. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE Newsroom. What a surprise. Hello. Good morning.
Happy 2018.
Yes. Sean Flynn returns. He's managing editor for Spectrum News. Charlotte, morning to you.
Good morning. Good to be back.
And Doss Helms is education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hello. Hello. She's giving the queen
wave
for those of you watching on Facebook.
Yeah, I had my New Year's queen, my New Year's crown.
Okay. And Eric Spanberg is a senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. He's here too.
Yes. No crown, but I'm glad to be here.
You want to trade chairs?
No, I'm good.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. And you can watch us on Facebook Live. The big news for a major portion of the East Coast and Midwest is the cold. It is brutally cold and snowing in some very strange places, particularly so for places that aren't used to this kind of weather. It's cold, I suppose. And perhaps no one is more impacted than Charlotte's homeless. How have shelters reacted to this?
Well, the way that you would hope they would in many ways. They opened, obviously tried to expand capacity or doing what they can to try to get the homeless to the shelters. It's often an aspect that people forget about, which is homeless folks don't, you know, often don't have the ability to cross town to get to a shelter that they know is open. And you know, that's the good news. The shelters seem to be doing basically what they can.
Yeah. Evidently, houses of worship have gotten involved. About 130 houses of worship have gotten involved in this. Other partners are working with shelters to provide beds and meals for people who can't get into shelters. That was about a week ago, the can't get into shelters. Have people not been able to get in? Are we
I think for the most part
who
they
want
have.
To get in?
The Room in the Inn program is an ongoing thing. It happens every year from December to March, and they sent out an email kind of as this cold front was rolling in and said, if you can take any extra people or do any extra nights, you know, we may have an overflow. They seem to be, I've heard individually on some nights they got everybody that showed up for Room in the Inn. Okay. The real challenge is people who are out there who are just not tapped into the system at all, who for whatever reasons, maybe it's they're a couple and so they would have to split up. Maybe there's just some real issues with group settings or with their own mental illnesses or whatever. There are people that just
won't come.
Are really trenched into, I live in this camp and that's how I live. Mm-hmm. And if it's 30 degrees at night, that you and I would not like that, but they're okay. But when you start talking, you know, 15 degrees, it gets pretty dangerous.
I guess the question is, how many homeless people do we have, do we know, and how many shelters do we have, and what's the capacity, and how's the capacity of the shelters compare with the homeless population number?
Those are all excellent questions, Mike. I do not have the answers to. I mean, the basics that I know are kind of similar to what Ann and Tom are saying, which is that it seems like the shelter process is working so far, to use so clumsy bureaucratic language, other than, of course, we have had the disagreement between the county manager, Dina DiOrio,
we'll get to,
and Pat Cawthon.
But I read yesterday that shelters have waived most of their restrictions for the duration of the cold weather. What restrictions do they have?
There are a number of restrictions, and it varies from shelter to shelter. If it's a men's shelter or a women's shelter, obviously the name implies a kind of classic limitation. Other homeless folks have pets, and they're not, you know, keen to leave their pets out in the cold while they go inside. There are all kinds of different – I mean, it's really a patchwork of restrictions. But, you know, the key thing here is getting back to the numbers. Numbers are hard to track down. I mean, every year we do a homeless count in Mecklenburg County, as they do in most areas, and that is at a best guess, a reasonable estimate.
And it's a snapshot in time.
Those numbers go up and down. But honestly, I have to say the Observer's done some great reporting this, including a story that you did, Ann, early on with a picture that just broke my heart when I saw it, which is you know, a family member holding a one-year-old as they were lining up, hoping to get inside.
And I was out there with our photographer, and I was really uncomfortable. And this was before it got intensely cold, and I was could not wait to get back to my car in my office. And you think they're out there with their baby, but you know, I think they got a room for the night, but this is, you know, and they were saying they hang out at Imaginon, the library for children, to keep warm during the day. They're trying to get stabilized. So that's the challenge. I mean, Charlotte has done some pretty good things as far as creating housing for people who have been chronically homeless, but their outreach team who's out there on the street trying to reach the people who are still on the street said, we'll get one group off a bench and we'll get them housed and you go out the next day. And, you know, and I remember driving around looking at the lights on Christmas Eve and seeing big clusters of people at transit benches and thinking, you didn't used to see this in Charlotte.
So I have been told by our Cracker Jack staff that the January 2017 homeless count came up with 1,476 homeless people. That's a snapshot in time. Nonetheless, that's what the count said.
And let's remember, I think there's a general misconception that if people are homeless, they may be dealing with drug addictions, they may be dealing with mental health issues. They're also just working poor. And, you know, again, I have to give another nod to another Observer article where, you know, a family was profiled that lost everything in Hurricane Matthew. So this is a relatively recent development for this family. And one of the sons, a 19-year-old, I believe, you know, had a, you know, the mother had works a couple different jobs. The 19-year-old works a couple.
Restaurant, right?
Yeah, exactly. Works in a restaurant as a busboy, and he came in with frostbite. That's how cold it can be. And frankly, and one of the more interesting things in the article is the general manager of the restaurant had no idea that he was homeless until he saw the frostbite and realized something needed to be
done. And started raising money. Yeah.
Right, and that was very good. To finish off that story, that the restaurant, the group came together, brought the family together, got them a hotel, started a GoFundMe account, and within a day that thing reached, I believe, it was up to $7,000.
Hmm. But I think the big point here is just the – even if you have the capacity – just the day-to-day nightmare of logistics.
Yes.
Because even if you get into a shelter, many times you have to leave first thing in the morning. What do you do all day? How do you get back somewhere else the next night? I mean, it just, you know, we're going through our lives from a heated car to a heated office to a heated home while people are struggling moment to moment to figure out how they're going to stay warm.
The public really seems to want to help.
Yeah.
When I did the first story in the middle of last week, the outreach group from Urban Ministry Center said, we're doing everything we can to get people inside, but some will not come inside, so we could use really heavy-duty blankets, gloves, sleeping bags, and they were overwhelmed with those. They have had to post on their website, don't bring us anymore, take that to crisis assistance, you know, cash donations. There are families who have a place to live but are facing eviction or are facing their utilities being turned off because they came up short on cash, so crisis assistance is helping with that. Urban Ministry is saying, if you know of somebody that looks vulnerable out on the street, go to our website, urbanministrycenter.org, and we have a form where you can tell us where to find them, and we'll go out and try to get them help.
And while it's really cold here in Charlotte today, up in the mountain counties, it's some places it's below 0 degrees. We featured a couple of homeless shelters in Watauga County, and they had infants there. I know we were talking about the one-year-old. They had a two-month-old, and they just were doing everything they could to get diapers and milk for the baby. And it's almost heartbreaking when you see these families with these infants in there just doing everything they can to survive.
So Mecklenburg County went so far as to fix the heated Grady Cole Center in preparation for the impact of the cold. The plan is to open it as a warming center. I'm not sure what that means, but just a place to go to get warm, I guess. But they decided not to open it, despite pleas to the board from Commissioner Pat Cotham. And WSSC-TV spoke with about this with County Manager Dina DiOrio.
We're not a shelter, right? We do not provide shelter. Under extenuating circumstances, we'll open a warming station. But if there's enough capacity to house people who need shelter in a situation like this, and we know that, then we will not open our shelter.
So the county has set aside Grady Cole as a warming center, chose not to do it. They must have some criteria for opening that center. Which boxes have to be checked?
There's a couple of different boxes. One of them is you have to have sustained wind chill, temperature of 10 degrees, sustained for 24 hours. Another one is overflow capacity at current established shelters, meaning, you know, there's more need than supply of beds. There, you know, another one is an increase in the number of 911 calls for weather-related incidents. There are a couple, but I think the criterion – look, counties, governments are run by criterion. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. It's how bureaucracy works. But there are times, I believe, when criterion itself needs to be set aside for some common sense.
Well, that's what Pat Cotham thinks. She's a county commissioner, and she was very upset about the decision not to open.
These are people. I think we do more for pets sometimes than we do for people. I mean, even if we only had a few families there, it would still be worth it to me.
She spent part of the evening after making that comment, after the council and the county manager made the decision not to open up the shelter or the warming center. She went out and handed out hand and foot warmers to the homeless uptown. Do we know if people suffered because of this decision not to open the warming center? Do we know?
I think the question would be, would they have gone there?
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess you could argue, well, again, you know, Urban Ministry Center has their street outreach team, and it's only four people, which, again, if that 1,400 is an accurate count, you know, they can't do everything. But there are people who will get people. There are a lot of smaller groups that are saying, I just saw something from a youth group that's going to have overnight stays tonight and Saturday night. So people are trying to do things, but it is not as easy as it sounds. It takes a lot of volunteers to really have a good, safe shelter.
How were schools affected by this cold snap? Evidently, CMS wasn't really affected at all.
They were not. They
had some heating outages, right?
They had some heating outages. North Mecklenburg High School was closed for one day because there was so little heat that they couldn't convene. There were a number of other schools. CMS said fewer than 50, so I'm guessing that's 49, but that had some problems, but it might just be a room or a hallway, so they kind of shuffled students. I've heard from some parents that they feel like the buses don't have heaters. CMS says they do. It's just, you know, if it's driving around and opening the door a lot, it may not feel very warm.
Right.
So they went back on Wednesday. A lot of the districts that went back on Tuesday had two-hour delays. Several surrounding districts still have two-hour delays today on Friday. So, but CMS has said, and
because of icy roads, why?
No, I think it's more getting the buses ready, making sure that your buses are ready to roll, and being concerned about the kids standing out at stops. And what CMS has said is, you know, if you get out early enough, you can have your buses ready to roll, and it's just not that much warmer 2 hours later. So
this just feels like a little bit of a shift to me, and as just as a CMS customer, so to speak, it felt like in past years they were a little quicker to pull the trigger on delaying school just because of really cold temperatures, and this time they didn't.
Is that because we have a superintendent who was in where was he?
Maryland.
Was
Maryland?
He in Maryland?
Yeah. Frederick County.
Frederick County, Maryland. Was that where he was? It's cold there in Frederick County.
It is.
So he's used to this.
Plus the cold winters of Baton Rouge, I'm sure. Never mind.
So there were also multiple power outages this week around the area. Was that due to the cold, or was it something else going on? You know?
It's probably a combination. I mean, and let's keep this in perspective. I mean, I think Duke reported somewhere along a few
1,500. Maybe?
Yeah, it's not a massive power outage, but a combination of things. Duke says part of it was traffic accidents due, you know, caused by the cold weather taking out key infrastructure. Another thing is, frankly, just the system not, you know, having the capacity to deal with people, you know, using so much electricity for heaters and things. You know, you see a spike in use, and it can actually, you know, cause some flawed systems to show their wear.
There was a couple of utility companies up in the mountains that actually asked their customers not to run their dishwasher, not to use anything that would require additional power because they were concerned about brownouts because the temperatures are so cold up there and everybody's running their heating system 24 hours a day.
We have more to talk about with the cold, not much more, a little bit more, including the fact that Donald Trump has gotten involved with the cold in a tweet. There's also been a county land swap we'll talk about and find out what the meaning of that's all about. And, of course, there's a lot to talk about with regard to the potential sale of the Carolina Panthers, who play in the playoffs this week against New Orleans, about which I'm sure our Cajun friend here, Eric, will have a lot to say. We have to take a break. We're coming right back. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. And Bee Yoga, with locations in Dilworth and Carmel Village in South Charlotte, now offering over 100 classes a week with newly added beginners series for the new year. More information available at beeyoganc.com. Bosses behaving badly have been outed nationwide, at least many high-profile bosses have, and that has sparked a nationwide conversation about what constitutes appropriate behavior in the workplace. This isn't just sexual harassment. This behavior includes bullying and other abusive behaviors, and one Wake Forest professor says that bullying bosses can make the bullied become bullies themselves. She and others join us to talk about that Monday at 9.
I'm Jane Clayson. Coming up on the next On Point, Trump and Bannon feud, Manafort sues, Iran protests, hot talk about nuclear buttons. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer. Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte. That's on cable for those of you with DirecTV. And Eric Spanberg. And Eric Spanberg is here from the Charlotte Business Journal. Snow. We had snowfall as far south as Florida this week. Mm-hmm. Very weird. Snow fell in Tallahassee, went through Hilton Head. A friend of mine sent me a picture of their – they were at the beach in Hilton Head.
And wow. Lovely week at the beach.
Out of their hotel room with snow on the pool. Nice. It was very exciting.
Charleston got hit really
hard. 5 inches.
They did.
Yes, really bad. What was it, 5 inches?
Five inches. Most since 1989.
They are not equipped in Charleston for that. So there was a this is all due to this, what do they call it, a bomb cyclone.
And
states of emergency were declared in Florida and Georgia and Virginia and here in North Carolina.
Our seasoned coastal residents who are used to powerful storms and nor'easters aren't really used to the blizzard conditions that have been found out there, and that's rare for our state.
So that, of course, is North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper. Did we get blizzard conditions in North Carolina along the coast or down east?
I can't vouch to specific blizzard conditions, but we do know there was snow and high wind, right. And if you get those at the same time, you'll end up with a blizzard.
Which area was hit hardest here? Do we know?
I believe it was the real northeast of the state. I mean, certainly along the coast, any accumulation of snowfall is going to seem just almost alien. I mean, we're just joking about Charleston, but, you know, you get out to the Outer Banks or you go to Elizabeth City, and they're not really prepared for this either.
It's very weird to see snow on a beach.
Yeah, that's just very jarring.
And there were pictures on television. This had nothing to do with the local news, but there were pictures on television of the surf. Mm-hmm. The ocean surf being frozen over with big chunks of ice being battered up against coastlines.
You know, I can remember that from when I went to Northwestern University and we were on Lake Michigan. And
that's not salt water.
The waves, no, it was not. But it's just beautiful to see waves freeze. They
really?
Turn out very pretty. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind next time I want to be frozen solid. Charleston received, as we said, near record snowfall, but it's all over now. Except for the cold, that's done.
Well, it looks like at least listening to NPR's newscast earlier today, it sounds like there is another cold wave that may be coming our way.
Okay.
We'll have to wait to see.
And the other problem is the temperatures just aren't melting what's there, so it's just staying frozen.
Donald Trump, who has been busy tweeting about almost everything under the sun, including the cold snap, had this to say. He said, it could be the coldest New Year's Eve on record. Perhaps we could use a little bit of that good old-fashioned global warming that our country, but not other countries, was going to pay trillions of dollars to protect against. Bundle up. Was he debunking climate change there or merely reinforcing his reason for pulling out of the Paris climate?
I think he was reinforcing his lack of scientific rigor and knowledge.
I do have to say this tweet led to one of my I'm about to do something I can honestly say that as a journalist I never ever thought I would do, and that's counter one former reality TV star's tweet with another former reality TV star's tweet. Yeah. And this one I can't read verbatim because we can't say certain words. But this one, and I'll read the tweet and then tell you who it's from. Mm-hmm. Quote, I think climate change is more complex than global warming will make it hotter. It has to do with disruptions of atmospheric conditions, ocean patterns, jet streams, and stuff like that. That is obviously in response to President Donald Trump's tweet. It comes from Vinny, former star of the Jersey Shore, something I never thought would be
well,
the statement.
He's a constant follow for
rationale.
You on Twitter, right? You follow Vinny.
And did you ever think the president would be intellectually smacked down by
Vinny? Is Vinny the same guy as The Situation? Is that
No. No.
Meanwhile, speaking of fun in the cold, Sean Flynn, you guys at Spectrum found some benefits to cold weather. You did a story on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, everybody's doing is complaining about how cold it is, but there's actually a lot of really good things out there that come of this really cold temperatures. A couple of the big ones, You know, every year the mosquitoes, they're not here in the winter anyway. They normally burrow underground. But when it gets this cold, it kills all their eggs. So it's a good chance next summer we won't have as many mosquitoes. And we won't have all those West Nile stories to do. The emerald ash borer, which is actually coming through North Carolina as we speak, killing the ash trees across North Carolina, they're dying off. My personal favorite is, did you know you actually burn more calories shivering in 10 minutes of cold weather than you do working out for an hour?
Is that true?
That is true. They did a study on that, Virginia Commonwealth University.
Lucky there. Clip and save.
And there's a lot of other benefits out there, including apparently there's been studies that show 9 months from now there's a big baby boom.
Bum, 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 bum.
Oh.
So we'll play
Marvin Gaye.
Cue up Marvin Gaye.
There we go.
Cue up Marvin Gaye. Mecklenburg County Commission this week approved an exchange of land with the Charlotte Housing Authority that will allow the expansion of Pearl Street Park. Where's that park? How does this swap help?
I know it's just outside the, I-277 loop?
Yeah, it's right over by the Metropolitan,
across
the street from the Metropolitan. And essentially this is another ramification of that area growing, and it's going to be the land that's being swapped will be developed commercially. And Peter Pappas, who had worked on the Metropolitan, real estate developer here, is going to work on that project.
This is on the other side of the street.
Correct.
Other side of, what is that?
Kenilworth.
Kenilworth.
Yeah.
So the county will swap a 3-acre Baxter Street Park for a 2-acre parcel of land abutting Pearl Street Park. And because the parcels aren't the same size, the housing authority is going to pay the county $2 million.
Right.
Both these parcels are on either side of a housing authority apartment building on Baxter Street. So what have we gained here? What's the end result?
Land you can develop is really what it boils down to for both parties. And that's the key thing here. The housing authority is spending the $2 million because they believe, although they have not laid out plans, but they clearly, given their mission, you can infer that they believe that they can somehow use this land to expand that project, their housing, their affordable housing.
Is the housing authority under the auspices of the city or the county?
More city than county.
Yeah,
that explains the need to pay money for the swap.
Correct.
Right, and that's not unusual.
But wait, $2 million they're paying for 1 acre of land. Isn't that a lot of money for an acre of
land?
Well,
it's yes and no. I mean,
that makes my house worth a lot more than I thought it was.
It's all about location.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know that your house is on the edge of Uptown. And
I can tell you there's a 13-acre site in the heart of Uptown with a big concrete circle on it that's worth a whole lot more than $1 million an acre.
Okay. All right. So before the holidays, Mecklenburg County Computer.
Mike Collins, assessor.
There'll be a lot of
he's
going to
do the next reval.
There'll be a lot of those jobs coming up, and I have some free time.
Okay, good.
Before the holidays, Mecklenburg County computer files were victim to a ransomware attack. We talked a lot about this before the Christmas break. The county took the rare step when it comes to these things. They refused to pay the ransom, and that garnered the praise of Commissioner Matthew Ridenour.
I was like, that's so bad. Yeah, that's like telling the terrorists, like, no, we do not negotiate with terrorists. And so I thought that was a bold statement to make.
Dina Dorio as Jack Bauer.
I was going to say as Chuck Norris, but either way.
I don't know if the county thought that they were being bold or merely prudent. They said it would take just as long to repair the damage and restore their files by paying the ransom as it would if they didn't. Were they right? Is everything back to normal?
Getting there. The short answer is getting there. They originally said all the servers would be back up and running before the end of the year. Now they're saying it should be done by the end of this week.
Hmm.
This is a complicated process. I think missing deadlines in this situation is understandable. They're still trying to piece back together what they have, what they can trust, and what is gone.
How has this impacted things like the real estate business? Because you've got to access all kinds of files all the time.
Well, they're doing things old school is what they're doing. I mean, people are going through documents, and you just can't. The real estate site just went back up. Very recently. That one took a while.
I know a couple of developers who said it was causing some delays and problems for them, but I think it also came at a really good time when people really didn't mind not working for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, the message is get hacked in December. That's a good time.
So not only are they repairing and restoring these files, they're also, I understand, developing revised security protocols. How will things change going forward with how things work? Because this was kind of a
Well, they haven't said exactly how they will change it. Nor will they, because for obvious reasons, then people would hack again or try to hack again. But they are accelerating it, in essence, their security upgrades, which I think were what going to take place over a 2 or 3 year period, are now going to be done as quickly as possible, obviously, to avoid this situation repeating itself.
I can say one visual thing that has happened when you get emails now from county officials. It often includes this giant yellow text box
glaring at you.
Yeah, like, basically everything but a neon sign that basically says, don't click on unknown links. Don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't.
Well, but our system, you know, I get that anytime I get an email that says, this person is not in your contact list, be very wary. And it's like, I'm in a newsroom. You know, that's
what
I get dozens of those
do?
Every day. Yeah.
So you'll be the person responsible for taking the paper down. That's what
I think I'm pretty careful about not opening attachments.
So they're still working on a report for the county commission on just how all this happened. Is it more complicated than the original story that we all know, that somebody opened an email that looked real because it came from – allegedly came from somebody that they knew or that was in the office and it had an attachment, but the email address had been spoofed and it wasn't that person? It could happen to anybody.
Well, I don't think that is the question so much as the mechanics of how it happened, what it did, how they prepared it, how to protect themselves in the future. I think that's really the information that they want, and that's – why they will discuss this in a closed session. They're not going to discuss that publicly.
Mike, think of it this way. You could read a Cliff Notes version of War and Peace, and it's probably going to be 15 pages. Does that mean that the book, you know, you already know every key point. Does that mean that the 1,000-plus War and Peace is not worth reading? It's just basically a more detailed account of exactly what went down and what they're going to do.
Yeah, so the question is, have you read War and Peace, Mike?
I actually have a copy of War and Peace.
Of course he has.
But no, I have not.
He has a copy.
He has a copy.
I have a copy. Right.
You know, I think
it's
Mike...
It's very impressive. It impresses people.
It's right next to Infinite Jest, right?
Right.
You know, Mike, one of the things that I wanted to add on this is that, you know, we've been doing stories for years about how companies, especially these small businesses, really need to up their cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. And I think for the most part, a lot of these small businesses, just because they didn't have the time or the resources, just said, I'll do it later. I won't do it. I think this whole Mecklenburg County cybersecurity issue has really caused a lot of them to take a second look. I know a lot of cybersecurity companies are really busy right now, and they're getting a lot more business. So if nothing else, this definitely sent a message to a lot of businesses to, hey, you need to up that.
And evidently there's this big thing going on with the microprocessors that are vulnerable to this new thing called Spectre and something else. And Microsoft and Apple and Android people are issuing updates. And people need to allow their computers to update themselves, because that's going to be a problem if you don't. All right. The stunner.
The more you know.
Bum, bum, bum. The stunner going into
the NBC.
The stunner going into the end of the year, of course, had to do with the Panthers. Owner Jerry Richardson, who just days after allegations surfaced about misconduct in the workplace, announced that he would sell the team. So the team won't go on the market until the last game has been played, which means Monday.
You mean Monday after the Super Bowl?
but this week they announced that an investment bank, they announced the investment bank that would be handling the sale, Allen and Company, whoever they are. What do we know about
them? Whoever they are. They are very prominent, particularly in sports and media finance. They're a sort of boutique investment firm in New York. They've done a lot of work with sports franchises and transactions. And actually, one of the Panthers' former minority owners, who died a couple of years ago, was the former chairman of the board of Allen & Company. So this is not a surprise that Jerry Richardson and the Panthers would go with Allen & Company. They also hired a couple of law firms, one of whom, Proskauer Rose from New York, is the firm that gave us David Stern and Gary Bettman, who are the former NBA commissioner and current NHL commissioner. So that's a long way of saying they have a whole lot of sports expertise here as they get ready to put this team on the block.
And Rick Rothacker, whose name I can never say, even when he's sitting in the room, wrote in The Observer that some Charlotte bankers say the choice of Allen and Company is a good one because they will likely have fewer conflicts of interest with potential buyers than the larger banks would have. What does that mean, conflicts of interest? Bank of America has their name on the stadium. Is that a conflict of interest?
No, because of your client list. You represent buyer and seller. Okay. And a lot of the speculation is that B of A will probably be involved with some of this.
Yeah, but also
buyers.
Also because some of these banks may be involved in the financing of a deal.
Yeah, I
mean, talking about $2.3 billion, so that itself can be an inherent conflict.
It's almost inevitable that B of A will be involved somehow in the financing of the next owner. I mean, that's it's not required, but it's likely.
So speculation about a buyer has been running rampant. We heard about the potential of P. Diddy wanting to buy the team. But yesterday, I think it was just yesterday, the Business Journal and the Charlotte Observer reported that Felix Sabatis has formed a local group to bid for the Panthers that already has enough investors to pursue an NFL franchise but be willing to take on more investors. What do you know about this?
Well, so Felix Sabatis, a lot of people will be familiar with his name. He's been a race car team owner, NASCAR team owner. He is a minority partner in the Hornets. Right. When they were the Bobcats, he famously tried to give away his ownership share to charity. Owns a lot of car dealerships. Anyway, Felix Sabatis is sort of the point man for this local group. We don't have the names of the other investors who have joined with him, but he has said pretty clearly he is not the main money guy, but would be an investor, and his basic take is that he wants to keep the team here, and so that's why he's involved. But I will say, Mike, he has told me and the Observer and everyone else over and over that it has to make financial sense.
And $3 billion. The team is valued between $2.3 and $3 billion, and he says $3 billion doesn't
make
sense.
He's saying two is more likely, although, of course, this is in that negotiating stage where the seller wants to say, oh, my goodness, it's worth so much, and the buyer wants to say, not so much. But
updated the bathrooms.
Rick Rothacker's story this morning said that Felix Sabatis said that the five-person group at this point includes a couple of the current minority owners and a couple of, quote, sports celebrities whom he would not name.
Right. He's a minority owner of the NASCAR team and part of the Charlotte Hornets organization, even though he wouldn't be the major owner. Will the NFL rules allow him?
Yes. As a minority owner, you could be.
Okay. But there is an interesting thing that needs to happen here. Somebody needs to be the majority owner, I believe, by NFL rules. And they decide that based on how much of the team you can afford to buy without issuing debt.
30%.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're talking $600 million. Just let's say the price is $2.25 billion.
Where Bill France comes in? Because WCNC TV, Brian France. WCNC TV has been reporting that, and I don't think Felix Sabatis has refuted it, but he didn't say one way or the other, and I think NASCAR has denied it, but Brian France is rumored to be interested in it.
Yeah, and Brian France, you would think,
head of NASCAR,
right, has the money. He's a third generation member of NASCAR's founding family. Interestingly, he does not own any part of NASCAR anymore, according to numerous reports over the years. His uncle and sister do, so that is making it a little hard to determine exactly where his net worth is. But yes, that would be the motivation to bring someone like him in. And remember, Mike, no matter what anybody's saying around town, this is national. So whoever's got the biggest checkbook and can pass the vetting test, remember, that's going to be especially important in this circumstance. That's who's going to wind up with the team.
Jeff Bezos, Amazon.
Checks all the boxes.
That's right. There's still
it's
more
a two for one.
And free shipping.
Yes.
There's still more to talk about this. We'll come back and do that, and we'll also talk about their playoff prospects, the Panthers' playoff prospects, judicial redistricting, and more. There was a silent march yesterday. Who knew? We'll find out about that, too, when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeast Digestive Health Center. The practice has expanded to help support the growing community. A second location at Edison Square in Concord is now open and ready to serve patients' GI needs. More info at northeastdigestive.com. And Acosta Heating and Cooling, providing heating, air conditioning, and air purification systems to the Charlotte metro area over 45 years. Acosta Heating and Cooling online at acostainc.com. A tell-all book ignites a feud between President Trump and former advisor Steve Bannon. Anti-government protests break out in Iran. The president and North Korea's Kim Jong-un go back and forth over their nuclear buttons, or the size of them. Those are just some of the stories that they'll be talking about as the national news roundup proceeds following our roundup during On Point with guest host Jane Clayson coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. And we will be right back as well. Stay with us.
This is Guy Raz, host of the TED Radio Hour and How I Built This. And I'm always looking at how great ideas developed into successful businesses and institutions. And you know how this station developed? With one listener donation at a time. And now, listeners like you can even donate an old car. We'll turn it into Morning Edition, all things considered, even the TED Radio Hour, so you can hear more stories about great ideas.
Click on the support tab at WFAE.org to learn more.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Sean Flynn from Spectrum News, Ann Doss Helms from The Observer, Eric Spanberg from The Business Journal, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. We're talking here at the moment about the potential sale of the Panthers. And one of the things that I think Felix Sabatis mentioned, I may be wrong about that, was the next owner's need for a new domed stadium.
Think big, Mike.
Will any new owner be asserting that need, or is it just Felix Sabatis' group that is asserting the need for a – can you just put a dome on the current stadium?
Yeah, you just throw a lid on
He's
there.
He's a car dealer. Can't he make it a convertible?
Right.
I mean, come on. Is there that – Mark Washburn wrote a long article today in the paper about – make no mistake about this. This is not – this team may not necessarily stay here. That you're going to have to ante up for what the new ownership team wants.
I think he's half right. I think you're going to have to ante up. I'm very doubtful that the team is going to leave, which means they'll be in Tulsa tomorrow. But I do think that, you know, the stadium's 22 years old, and we know that $180 million has been invested in renovations in the last 5 years in the stadium. And so a logical person would say, well, why in the world would you be talking about a new stadium? Because that's the way sports works is the answer. And when you see the Atlanta Falcons playing in a billion and a half dollar
that stadium down there. It's remarkable.
Yeah, $1.5 billion stadium. You know, you have the Cowboys stadium that opened 8 or 9 years ago. That was over $1 billion. Basically, you're looking at $1 billion plus. And the reason owners want these new stadiums, of course, is that they can build, you know, more and more luxurious seating areas, restaurants, club, private clubs, all these things, some of which this stadium has, but they don't have the latest and the greatest. And so, yes, I do think a new stadium will be discussed probably shortly after the new owner comes in, maybe a year or two into their tenure once they sort of get the lay of the land. And so that will be a big civic fight like we have in all American cities.
And
when
the
we
question
have those
is, where are you going to put it? And, and I guess
probably near your house since you have that acreage that's so valuable.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a good thing that we didn't put soccer where Memorial Stadium is because now we can put it there. This all has potential, the sale of the team and what happens to the stadium has PSL owners a little concerned, and they should be because these are the guys that put up the money to build the current stadium for the right to continue to buy season tickets. What happens to those people if the team moves or if they have to build a new stadium? What happens to those people?
Well, Katie Peralta wrote this week in The Observer, and this is absolutely correct. This has always been the case that the seat license contracts only cover the existing stadium. So if the Panthers built a stadium next door, the seat license would not carry over, or if they move anywhere else, they would not carry over. Now, I think it's pretty obvious that those are the best customers the Panthers have, the most loyal customers the Panthers have. So any owner in his or her right mind would want to do something to at least partially grandfather in or, you know, curry favor with those loyal fans, because if you turn off your most ardent customers, that's probably not a really good way to run your business. But
how many PSL owners are there?
There are, I think there are about 25,000 PSL owners that account for about 62,000 seats in there. So it's an ingenious plan because it not only paid for half or so of the construction of the original stadium, but you have your tickets are basically sold out every year. You know, they only have 7,000 or 8,000 tickets left over per game because of the PSLs. And if you don't re-up your season ticket, then you lose your seat license.
Well, and I guess you could literally give them their seats to take home permanently.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Here you go. Here you go. Turn on the TV and sit in your
$7,000.
Okay. After last Sunday's game against Atlanta, has the price of the team dropped any? The team turned in a pretty miserable performance, or as Coach Ron Rivera said.
We missed some opportunities. You know, we had some balls ricochet off hands that got intercepted. We missed some throws. A lot of things happened that didn't work in our favor.
And if you think he sounds calm, how about Cam?
You know, fumbles in the backfield, miscommunication in the pass game. You know, just things that it's easily corrected.
So Newton can sometimes be morose after a loss. Is this up? This, I'm going to coin a phrase here. This upbeatness, is this misplaced in the light of the playoff game ahead in New Orleans?
Well,
New Orleans.
We could answer that about 7:30 on Sunday evening. Whether it's, predicting the NFL is all but impossible. So either the Panthers will be for sale on Monday, or they'll be preparing for their next playoff game.
Tom Sorensen wrote a column this week in The Observer, and he's the retired sports columnist. He sounds a little like it's going to be on sale Monday.
It is a tough game. I mean, if we're going to talk straight football, let's talk straight football. I mean, New Orleans still has Drew Brees. I don't know how, but that guy is still playing in his prime at a time when he is, and this is not a knock, but honestly, if you look at your classic NFL quarterback, Drew Brees should have been done years and years and years ago, and he is still doing great. And he's got weapons in the backfield. Yeah. Like, they have running backs
for
now
the first
and
time
line.
In years.
Yeah, plus absolutely. He's playing in a dome stadium. It keeps you young.
Yeah. They're tough at home, by the way. The Saints are very tough at home.
I also want to add that it seems like Panthers fans are always doomsdayers. It seems like we're always – we won 11 games this year, and we've been in the playoffs for the last 5 years. Yeah. We need a little of that confidence. We're going to win this thing.
Looky there.
We're going to Super Bowl 52.
Win one for Sean Flynn, by God.
dome, home, dome. I saw that in the paper this morning. That's how we win.
And we've heard some of the players saying, we would like to send Jerry out with the Super Bowl championship.
Oh, that would be very nice.
He certainly would like it, too, since it would raise the value of the franchise.
So before the end of last year, we were talking about something called judicial redistricting in North Carolina. And in 2018, we still are. State Republicans are trying to agree on new judicial district lines and whether to replace head-to-head elections for judgeships. Yesterday, you covered a silent march in uptown Charlotte about judicial redistricting. How do people know what side they were on?
Oh, they made it very clear with signs and, silent marches always have this symbolic piece of tape over one's mouth. And most of the marchers yesterday had exactly that. And written across the front of the black gaffer's tape were words like fair justice, silenced. They were there. It was about 3 dozen of them in the cold. That was in, a larger number than I anticipated. And they were there to protest what they see as a potential move to do what amounts to, judicial gerrymandering to favor a particular political party, in this case the Republicans.
So explain that. What do the Republicans want to do?
Well, it's complicated because it's a multi-pronged thing, and we don't actually know if they're going to do this yet. The General Assembly is due to come back for a special session on Wednesday. It's not clear yet whether or not they have the votes to do this, but this is the headlining act of that special session. So what they want to do is redraw the districts for judges in North Carolina, district judges, Superior Court judges, those kinds of positions, because here in North Carolina, we do elect judges. Now, on the pro side of this proposal is the fact that the judicial boundaries are outdated. They haven't been touched and redrawn in decades and decades, which means that you have some that could have a voting population of, say, 270,000, and others that might have a population as small as 75,000. And those two judges would be running for equal positions but with vastly different populations electing them. However, on the con side of this proposal, the way they're redrawing it heavily redraws urban areas, those positions in urban areas, which obviously tend to be Democratic, and largely leave rural Republican judicial districts alone. So the claim by Democrats is simply that the Republicans keep losing in court. So now they just want to completely remake the court system to be more favorable to their laws.
But wouldn't this go to the federal courts ultimately if there was a problem with it? And wouldn't they be facing the same kind of redrawing of maps again because the federal courts say this is wrong?
It's possible.
And when they're already facing the need to redraw maps in the legislative district and the congressional districts, and they're still waiting for the final decision on one of those, is this a good time to open another can of worms?
You would have to ask House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger to answer that question.
So meanwhile, Democratic State Senator Joel Ford will face a primary challenger, Attorney Mujtaba. Is that how you say his name? Mujtaba Muhammad is entering the District 38 Senate race. He advocates universal pre-K, criminal justice reform, and education. Can he give Ford a run for his money in the primary?
Yes. And here's why. He was also the vice chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Party. That is the key thing here. You've got State Senator Jill Ford, who, of course, came in third to be Charlotte's mayor in the Democratic primary. He's very much a moderate, at times siding more with the Republicans than the Democrats. When you're dealing with a Democratic primary, you are dealing with people who don't often see that as a good thing.
Well, Muhammad has said he's out of touch and supports a reckless Republican agenda.
Which is what you would say if you're running against the incumbent.
Right. And he has – Tom's absolutely right. I mean, Senator Ford has come under a lot of criticism within his own party because he has, compared to other Democrats, gotten along much better with the Republican leadership. And it is viewed as a conservative Democrat in some circles.
Well, yeah, and he's also seen as a weak candidate for this reason, potentially for this reason alone. Cardinal Innovations Healthcare. Mm-hmm. Been in the news a lot lately for excessive severance packages. A severance package nowhere near as high as former CEO Richard Topping's $1.7 million package went to State Senator Joel Ford, who received around $50,000 in severance when he walked away recently. Mm. That is not illegal, but it can be portrayed as being questionable. And frankly, I think you're going to see Democratic, and especially in the Democratic primary, I think
that's a campaign issue. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And they're going after Joel Ford because they sense weakness.
Okay. So you wrote this morning, Ann, I think it was this morning, that the state Senate's mandate for smaller K-3 class sizes will mean that CMS has some problems that the legislature needs to fix, and fast. What does this all mean?
Well, this stems from the mandate that K-3 class sizes become smaller, which means you need literally more physical classrooms in those grade levels and more teachers. And this has been a huge thing in Raleigh and around other parts of the state, and CMS has been fairly quiet on this. But yesterday, the school board had a breakfast meeting with 11 local legislators, and the House has already done what I think the school districts would like to see them do, but the Senate has not. Mm-hmm. And the Senate leadership has been saying, oh, gosh, we're not really sure we can even do this in the session that starts next week. And so CMS and their spokesman, Charles Jeter, who used to be a state legislator, was making the case that you absolutely can do this and you must do this. You can't drag it out because we are doing our budget right now. And if this mandate holds, we need to buy 200 more trailers, mobile classrooms. And those old ones that we promised you we were going to get out of circulation and replace, they're going to stay where they are because we got to be wheeling these into elementary
schools.
And
there's a $20 million price tag to doing this.
There is,
that the school system would have to pay.
And they're saying, we got to order these. We can't just run out to the used trailer lot and buy them, a week before school starts. We're going to have to start signing some contracts. So.
And it would also mean overcrowding in other classrooms. If you have fewer people in the K-3, why does that cause a ripple effect down the –
Well, you either do completely adding on. We can hire all these teachers. I think they're saying it's well over 300 teachers. Or you say, well, if we have more K-3 teachers, perhaps we have fewer in grades 4 and 5. Mm-hmm. The big thing that's been out there across the state has been if you do this, we're going to have to get rid of all of our art and PE and music classes. And Clayton Wilcox, who for the first time really made a clear statement on this, said, no, I will not do that. I think that is absolutely wrong. This is an essential part of education for young children. So, maybe the county writes us a check for these 300 teachers. Wouldn't bank on that. So if we have to start shifting people, we put more kids into the 4 and 5 classes, we start reassigning teachers, that may spill over into middle and high schools.
So it also appears that the idea that the cities of Matthews and Mint Hill could create their own charter schools is not a dead issue. And this did spark what you described as a fierce debate when CMS leaders and state legislators met this week. Refresh our memories on this.
So this is a local bill that was introduced by Bill Brawley of Matthews, and it stems from all of the turmoil that was going on in Matthews, partly in response to the student assignment review, to fears that their local schools were going to be disrupted. And the school board's position is, look, they were worried that we were going to do something that we didn't do. And we've made our decisions and we didn't do it, so this is a dead issue. And Bill Brawley made a very pointed – they were going at each other pretty hard, Charles Jeter and Bill Brawley. And he said afterward, hey, we play hardball. We're used to this. But Jeter and the CMS crew were saying – this makes it very hard for us to have a working relationship. You are setting up a situation in which a city which is whiter and more affluent than the rest of the county can use its own revenue to set up essentially a parallel school district while still having access to CMS. You know, they get everything we provide, but they can opt for these charter schools, which people are already opting for charter schools, but if the city sponsored these, they could give their residents preference.
Well, so. Jeter called it a seismic change in the education policy of the state and a resegregation of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools.
Yeah, it would be viewed as essentially setting up charter schools, which will be – the operating money will come from the state of North Carolina and the county of Mecklenburg, but it would have seating priority for people, again, in a city or town that looks different from most of Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools.
There are other things to talk about, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about how Rhonda Lennon, who has spent 8 years on the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board and also a lot of time on social media, went viral over the holidays because of something she shared on Facebook Live, a trip down the aisle with an Elvis impersonator. You wrote this story, Anne. Was this about a hunk of burning love? What was this about?
This was about it's a second marriage for both her and for Brent Cheek. She's divorced. He's widowed. And they just thought it would be a lot of fun. And, again, she likes to share her life with people. So we knew about their romance from following her on Facebook. We knew when he proposed. And we could all tune in, and I did, to watch the Elvis impersonator walk her down the aisle and say their vows.
But that music means a little less conversation.
That's right. Oh, well played.
All right, that's all the time we have. Ann Doss Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Sean Flynn, Managing Editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for the hour. Lord Almighty.